I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The Following On podcast is proudly sponsored by Barbados Tourism. Before we kick off the show, I just wanted to take a moment to remind you that the ICC Men's Cricket T20 World Cup final is taking place in Barbados this summer. This, by default, gives all of my fellow cricket fanatics the perfect excuse to go and book a holiday to Barbados in June and experience firsthand the euphoric atmosphere at the Kensington Oval, the cricket mecca of the Caribbean. If the cricket alone isn't enough to tempt you, then let me be the one to remind you that a trip to Barbados can also include leisurely strolls along the breathtaking coastline, mouth-watering flavours of the world-class Bajan cuisine, and of course, plenty of rum. Head to visitbarbados.org/cricket today to book the trip of a lifetime to Barbados, the best place to be a cricket fan.
You're listening to Following On here on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, along with former England fast bowler Steve Harmison. So England have named their 15-man provisional squad for the T20 World Cup, with Jofra Archer returning and Tom Hartley earning a surprise call-up. We'll hear from Managing Director Rob Key. The Daily Telegraph's cricket news correspondent Will McPherson joins us to discuss the story in his newspaper last week regarding the potential sale of the 100 and what that could mean for the domestic game. The Irish Times' Nathan Johns discusses Cricket Ireland's financial state after they had to cancel a bilateral series against Australia and move a home series against South Africa to the UAE in the summer. And we'll round up the week's other big stories as more England players hit centuries in the IPL and there's all change at Pakistan cricket. When isn't there? So plenty to come over the next hour. You're listening to Following On. Well, Harmy, let's begin then with the 15-man squad. I said it's provisional. There are no changes planned, obviously, but teams can change their squads right up until May the 25th for non-medical reasons. This is just a preliminary announcement, but as I said, it'll be medical reasons. So what stories grab you? We'll hear from Rob Key throughout this section, but where do you want to start? Overall, Tom Hartley is uncapped. Will Jacks is in the squads, never been to an ICC event before, but it'd be very hard to leave him out after what he did in the IPL this week. We'll discuss that in part four. So what grabs you?
Oh, well, obviously the headline, Jofra's back, which is brilliant. You'd like to see him play some form of cricket, and I think we will see him against Pakistan, which is a good thing. So hopefully we get a couple of games out of him in England there, starting at Leeds on England 22nd. So that's a headline, which is brilliant to see for Jofra more than anything else. I've thought about the England cricket team. I just want to see, you know, the lad play cricket because he hasn't played for such a long time. Wokes' omission, that's a surprise. I thought Wokes would have been a banker out there with the likes of a Pierce of Wood and Archer and left-arm option of Topley. I think they were always going to be in there. Tom Hartley, another one, a new name in over Riyan Ahmed. I'm not sure what happened there because I thought Riyan had done well when he came into the group when he was asked in the white ball stuff in the Caribbean and one or two other games that he's played. So that's a surprise. There'll be a lot of eyebrows raised over Ben Duckett's position in the group, but I think he's travelling as a backup batter and a left-handed option at the top of the order if England need that little change from right to left-hand, because when you look at Butler, Salt, Jacks, Bairstow, Brook, is a top, probably a top five, they're all right-handed. So I think they're the what I see. I quite like the squad. I think it's got a lot of depth. It's got a lot of options. I've got the 15 written in front of me and possible team order. And England can go one of two ways. They can go the Sam Curran way, which at number seven, play the extra bowler. Sam Curran as a as a batter and either two overs at the death or two overs at the start, because his bowling hasn't sort of hit the headlines it did during the last T20 World Cup. Or they can go with Sam Curran at number eight and play the extra batter, which would probably be Liam Livingstone in the middle order, who's having a little bit of a tough time in the IPL. But it gives them options. And the thing I like as well with Chris Jordan coming in is they've got the business overs. And what I mean by the business overs is the death overs. They've got options at the death. If you do play the extra bowler and you have Curran, you've got Archer, you've got Jordan, you've got three bowlers there that can bowl for the last four overs. And sometimes that's the difference between sides winning and getting to the semi-finals and final and potentially winning the World Cup, rather than, well, we're very, very good for 16 overs, but we concede 60 off the last four, and that 15-run difference between us and them is what costs us the big games. So I think the business overs are right. They've got power play overs. They've got death overs with Jordan added. I think all round it's a pretty decent side going over to the Caribbean and America to try and defend their title.
You mentioned the last four overs costing 60. That's quite prescient, because I was going to ask you about Sam Curran, and those were his bowling figures in the last game. I mean, he is having a really, really tough time. He's done nothing to warrant selection, but he was player of the tournament when England won the last World Cup. So, you know, I mean, he is struggling. He's struggling with bat and ball in the IPL. Most bowlers are. So that didn't raise an eyebrow then, his inclusion?
No, it didn't. I'd pick Sam. I think he's in the big contests playing for England. I think it's different to leading the Punjab Kings. To be fair, Punjab had a shocker, aren't they? I know we come on to another subject in a second, which I'll hold judgment and reserve opinion for actually it happening when it comes to the big players leaving the IPL. But there was no way that the Punjab Kings were getting to the knockout stages. So the likes of Wokes, if he was picked, Bairstow, Livingston or Curran, there's ever going to be a tough conversation for Rob Key and some rich Indian owners, shall we say, that they were going to miss the back end of the tournament because the Punjab Kings were never going to get anywhere near. But Sam, yeah, he has had a tough time. So's Liam. Liam Livingston's had a tough time. But I think out of the group that could have been selected, I still would have taken Sam. He doesn't have to play it, but I think I would always check him just in case he does get onto a little bit of a rich vein of form. If Sam Curran's playing at his best, he is still one of our best players in this format. He really is. He's dangerous with the bat. He's got good skills with the ball. He's always great in a contest, in a familiar shirt with familiar friends around him for England. I'd hope Sam Curran will stand up and, like he did in the last World T20 competition, be the player that we want him to be, because I think England are a better team when Sam Curran plays well.
Okay, well, before we move on to the subject of the IPL players, let's hear from Rob Key on a variety of the subjects that we've just mentioned.
Jofra's that bowler that is just so special. You do everything you can to try and get him back playing. And we've sort of taken the longer road this time. But as always with Jofra, it's fingers crossed until he's out there playing. You know, like when you're waiting for something really good to happen, you don't quite believe it till he's there. But he's tracking well at the moment. You know, the next step is when he gets into that Pakistan series is going to be full match intensity and how he keeps going through there. But at the moment, we're doing everything we can and he's in a good spot.
Just wondered if you could talk us through the decision to go to Chris Jordan.
You know, his bowling has always been a serious factor for us. The fact he can bowl at the death is always something that we look for. But it's his experience. But I think his batting seems to have kicked on a bit this time. So that, you know, we really want some strength, that depth. You know, we had people like Jamie Overton and all these guys who were all in the mix. And there was a list of them that we were looking at because we really wanted to make sure we had as long a batting lineup as possible. And CJ, the way that he's gone about not only his bowling, but his batting in the Big Bash, things like that. Having power as well, I think, is a big thing out in the Caribbean, which he has. So that's why CJ's comfortably got in there.
Can you explain why Chris Wokes was overlooked?
Well, I think the emergence a bit more of Rhys Topley, I think what he does with the new ball, you're always looking at the roles that people play. And you'd say that Wokes, his real specialism is in that with the new ball in the power play. Along, and if someone like Jofra Archer comes back into the mix, and then you're looking at, right, who's the other person to partner Jofra with that new ball? and Rhys Topley's just nipped ahead of him. And then someone like Chris Jordan, it's the batting. You know, we didn't factor in Chris Wokes' batting with as much power as someone like Chris Jordan. So that's why he then just misses out. It doesn't mean that we feel that he's done in white ball cricket, that's for sure. But, you know, it was pretty close. But, you know, there's just a number of factors in the end.
England director of cricket, Rob Key, at the press conference where the squad was announced. Now then, Harmy, Rajasthan Royals won the first IPL. You know where I'm going with this. They've waited 16 years to be in serious contention again. Josh Butler's a rather important member of their team. Kolkata Knight Riders are having their best IPL for a dozen years. Phil Salt has been massively responsible for that. So, I mean, I know that it's been announced that the IPL players are going to be returning for the four-match warm-up series against Pakistan. Okay, it's in black and white. We've been told it's happening. But I wait with bated breath to see whether it does happen.
Yeah, the 22nd of May can't come soon enough for me to see if Josh Butler, Phil Salt walk out for England opening the batting at Leeds against Pakistan in the first T20. You know, we spoke about rich owners. We're going to speak to Will McPherson soon about the 100 and the investment that comes in. And I'm sure the topic of conversation is where the England calendar and the schedule stands when it comes to investment into the 100, when, you know, rich owners go, well, we've paid for 6 weeks of your summer. We're going to have the best players in them 6 weeks of your summer. And I don't really care who you pick for England because we are going to have them. There's obviously been a conversation between Rob and Joss and Phil Salt. I'm sure there's been a conversation with directors of cricket at Kumar Sangakkara. And I don't know who Kumar, the director, is at KKR. I know Gautam Gambhir is involved in there, but I don't think he's the director of cricket. I'm sure there's been a conversation between Rob Key and the respected owners of the directors of cricket of these big IPL franchises. I'll be amazed if it happens. But I'll also, fair play to Keezy if he has put his foot down and said, look, and he's right. If he is right to do this. We've offered you a multi-year contract. We've tried to give you the best. We've gone to the pot to the ECB for 29 players for contracts to back you to play for England. Now, you have to turn up. But I'm not sure Rajasthan or KKR are going to see that when the season they're having. Josh Butler's got 200s. Phil Salt's been unbelievable. So that will be the headline. Yeah, I reckon it could. It could be a bigger headline. It's in black and white. Rob Key has said these players will be back for Pakistan. That could be a bigger headline than Jofra Archer coming back for England because of what the ramifications could be between a fight between ECB, director of cricket, and the big powerhouse owners of the IPL franchises. I'm waiting with bated breath to see if our leading stars come back and play against Pakistan in May. I'm not saying I'd be surprised, but I'd high-five Keezy again if he does get this right, because it shows, and I think it would be a message to everybody in England, that Rob Key's not frightened of the Indian owners. He's not frightened of making a big call and big decisions. If he does pull this off, then I would hope people around the country will know that their director of cricket is thinking England first and not, you know, because it's about momentum going into the World T20. And Rob Key has let players go and play a Pakistan Super League, for bilateral series, give them time off for bilateral series. But one thing he did say at the start, the most important thing is about tournament play. And this is important going into tournament play. If Keezy pulls this off, yeah, fair play to him. It's the best for English cricket. And that, for me, from a fan's point of view, it'd be heartwarming to see that happen.
It is a massive statement. It is a huge, huge statement. I mean, Rob Key is, in global cricket, he is man alone standing up to the IPL here. But you know what's going to happen, Homi, and we've got to move on here. But you know what will happen? It'll come down to Joss and Phil, Joss Butler and Phil Salt, because the owners will go directly to the players and say, are you kidding? Are you not thinking long term? Are you thinking about your future with us? Who pays you the most money? You're going to walk out. You've got us to the playoffs and you're going to walk out 2 days before the first playoff game. Are you serious? I mean, they'll be emotional blackmail applied.
Absolutely. They'll go to the players, but I think if they go to the players, it's because they didn't get anywhere with Rob Key. And I think Key's, you're saying, yeah, he's one-off, he's standalone. For me, I tell you what, if he does pull this off, fair play to him. I mean, and he's right to do it. He is right to do it because he's give the players a chance to make as much money as they possibly can in this in the period of time of bilateral cricket. And yes, you can say Pakistan is a bilateral series, but it's leading into a World Cup, leading into the World T20. And that, for me, is more important for England cricket team. He enhanced the big pool players because he's let other players go off and play. He's getting other players to play for England in that period of time. He's made a big decision on a 15-man squad. And this 15-man squad is going to take us to the World Cup. I need you to turn up and play in these games. And I'm sure if that's what was being said right from the very start when the contracts were issued, then he will stick to his word. Yes, I'm sure the owners will go to the likes of Butler and Salt and say, look, just remember what's further down the line. But unfortunately, their hands are tied. They've signed a contract and they're contractually bound to play for their national team. So tell you what, there's not many, well, you're right, you've seen, you stand alone. Not many people that do it, but knowing Keyes is, I do. I really hope that he gets this right and he pulls this off because it could be a message to the rest of the world to say, well, we can stand up to these big, rich, financial, you know, global owners because the international cricket is the most important cricket that needs to be played.
Okay, well, I would bet you a fiver that Phil Salt and Josh Butler don't open the batting against Pakistan at Headingley on May the 22nd, but I don't think you'd accept the bet. Let's finish this section. Say on the subject himself.
The thing with the IPL is you can't just call people back for no reason. You know, there is protections on that side. So we couldn't now, for instance, just say without injury or England commitments, we couldn't say to Phil Salt, for example, right, come back, you need a rest for the next 15 days, however long it is. But there is a window just before an England series that you can bring those players back for England duty or injury. But when they went out there, they were all asking, you know, what's going to happen with this Pakistan series? I sort of turn around to them and let all of them know and just say, look, there is a good chance that you'll be coming back. There is a chance you could stay out there. We may feel that if you get through to an IPL final, that maybe that's the best thing to do. It might be that if there's only one of you, then we'd let you go on and do that because it's about the eliminator and the finals. And if it's four or five of you, that obviously decimates our squad a little bit. So that's why we have to keep it pretty fluid. And now we've got to the point where actually we think, no, do you know what? We think it's more important that you come back and that group gets together. You know, the likes of Phil Salt opening the batting for England, getting that role going with Josh Butler. Josh has always said as well, without me prompting him, Josh has always said, look, I'm going to come back. I asked him very early on in the piece and said, look, as England captain, you're obviously going to have this series against Pakistan. How do you see it? And straight away he said, no, I want to come back and start getting ready for the World Cup and that series that's just before it. And when we sort of confirmed it when we spoke to them yesterday that this is going to be the plan.
It's Rob Key talking about the availability of the IPL players. You're listening to Following On here on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, along with former England fast bowler Steve Harmison.
Now, as promised, this is a conversation I'm looking forward to with Will McPherson, the Daily Telegraph cricket news writer and a great friend of the programme. In fact, we can call him a co-host whenever he's available, and there's only one of me and Harmy. Will, you've written the story of the week, and it may well be the story of the year and for many years to come. Let's headline it, shall we? Let's get a bit of clickbait in. The sale of English cricket. English cricket is selling itself for £500 million to future-proof the game. Give us an overview.
There's a story that my colleague Nick Holt and I wrote at the end of last week, last Friday, following a load of meetings between the ECB and the counties, the 18 first-class counties, their CEOs and their chairs, and as well as the MCC, who obviously own Lords and therefore are quite big players in the English game as well. And basically what they were discussing last week is what is now, really now, the inevitable sale of stakes in teams of in the 100, the idea being to raise funds, as you say, to kind of future-proof this game, which is to some people like a seriously controversial idea. The idea of just inviting private investment into the game in England in the way that so many other countries have done with their franchise leagues. The 100 hasn't technically been a franchise league until now. It's been a kind of short form, slightly shorter form league than most of the T20 ones, but it's not had kind of franchise ownership. But that is where we're headed, probably ahead of the 2025 season. The sale will happen later this year. So we reveal the kind of next step, I suppose, on the road to that, which is that the counties have been given a kind of slightly loose, which is just before the kind of ECB board meeting a few days later, to kind of green light, if you like, just allow the next stage of this to happen, which is them to kind of go out to the market in September. There are so many details about this that need to be fine-tuned. And the way the ECB have gone about it over the last year or so has been, I would say it's been very collaborative in that when you'll remember when the 100 came in, when it was first announced in 2018, it was sort of slightly forced upon people. It was kind of ECB's idea. This time they've really tried to collaborate and stuff, but there's some interesting ways they've gone about it. And it looks kind of like the host venues, the eight current host venues are going to majorly benefit from this agreement, while the other 10 counties are going to be kind of scratching around a little bit for their share. What is certain is that even if a lot of English cricket fans seriously valuable ways to mark this year, there's a lot of prospective ownership UK and abroad, inevitably in India. And I think some pretty familiar faces on the franchise ownership scene will pop up here as well, which will be interesting.
Well, me and you did some Q&As in India during the Test series, and a lot of older members of the cricket and first class, you know, viewing figures, they were irate. They weren't too happy about the 100. Whenever we threw it to the floor, apart from one really irate gentleman about your newspaper, but we'll come on to that in another time. But I mean, they were anti-100, weren't they? Their members were anti-100. And you say there's been a sort of collaboration and a talking to the counties, but they've been given 2 weeks to either take it or leave it. Is that, do you think that's fair? Is that the right way to go about it? Do you think there's mileage in them 10 counties coming together who aren't getting the bigger slice of the pie going, hold on, we need a bit more time and we need a bit more money if you're going to go down this route? And what happens if 8, which I'm sure it will inevitably become 10, if they do expand it further down the line, do they then detract from the other 10? And where likely is Durham and one possibly other that comes into that conversation? You said there's a lot of meat to go on the bones, but it just seems that if there is meat to go on the bones, it's 2 weeks enough.
Yeah, there's not a lot of time. So what the kind of thrust of our story last week was actually that the ECB have changed tack a little bit. And originally they were going to hold on personally to 19% of each team. Sorry, a lot of the numbers around this are really quite dry and dull. And they're quite, even in print, they're quite difficult to get across. But they were going to hold on to a stake in each team, which would give them a bit more control. But what the ECB have decided to do, and what they've offered the counties, is actually are going to sell every team 49%, and the proceeds of any share game, recreational game, the counties, etc. Now, it's a really unfortunate, quite uncomfortable trip for English cricket to face, but a lot of these counties are in a really, really tight spot financially. But that's for big grounds, have stacked up quite a lot of debt. Can they say no to these kind of figures? I'm not sure they can. The deadline they've been given of May the 10th, not very long or long away. And as it happens, quite a lot of county AGMs are, kind of just after the start of the season and just after the actual year, after they publish their results. So I would think some members will have their say. I don't think that the scope for a member veto on this one, like there is with the Strauss review. It's kind of difficult to explain, but again, it's like an overarching commercial decision for the game that doesn't necessarily, I'm trying to be careful with my words here, but doesn't necessarily directly relate to the running of the counties, even though it so obviously does. It's not questions about county teams, it's questions about the 100 teams. So I'm not sure the scope for the members to kind of get in the way of this, if you like, in the way that they have with some change of English game before. But let's see. I don't know. Maybe there'll be big kickoffs at a few AGMs over the next week or two, and we'll see. But I can't see it myself.
Well, I'm going to ask you for your impression now, okay? So I don't want to catch you out or get you into trouble. But this sort of 49-51%, is it your impression that people in English cricket believe that they can retain control? If they sell these franchises for £500 million, do they really believe that retaining 51% will actually give them control? If a Saudi conglomerate or an IPL team has forked out 40 or 50 million quid, I mean, my experience with the SA20 is, I mean, the Cricket South Africa are nominally majority shareholders, but they don't get a sandwich in board meetings. So is it your impression that they actually think they can retain control? And also, if you put 500 million quid in a high interest account, is that enough to future-proof the game?
Well, yeah, that's a very fair question, the final one there. I don't know. The belief that the reason they... private equity is coming, or private investment is coming into the game in England generally, is there's an overall belief that broadcast rights have peaked, and that, you know, the deal with English cricket's deal with Sky has been what's underpinned its finances for, well, since 2005. But that the feeling is that maybe the next deal won't be worth quite as much, and costs are rising, and it's a competitive player market, and all the rest. So you need more money. So that's why they've gone to private investment to get that money. Whether they can keep control, probably not. No, as you say, with the SA20, these guys who are investing aren't interested in minority stakes. They're not interested in being the junior partner. They're not interested in being the junior partners in the relationship. So, in the end, they're gonna be, you know, selling these teams off, you know, to majority shareholders. But what they've tried to do, and what I actually, to be honest, what I disagree with, is that, you know, I think it's a noble pursuit what they've tried, but what they're doing is they're gifting 51% to each host county. Now, I think that isn't right, because I don't actually think teams should have a host county. It should be shared across the game. And I think the proceeds, the way, if it was me doing this, I would have sold stakes in the team, in all of the teams, but I would have shared all the proceeds equally across the 19 shareholders of a recreational game. And then I would have provided the host county with big hosting fees for hosting those teams. Instead, what they've done is they've tried to link the 100 a bit more closely to county cricket, which is, you know, is a noble idea, but I don't think it is in real danger of widening the haves and have nots in county cricket. You know, you look at Surrey, and that 51% stake in Oval Invincibles, I'm sat here at the Oval now after Surrey beat Hampshire today, and it's looking gorgeous. It's, you know, it's this premier venue in central London. Like, I think Lords is going to be more valuable, but I think the Oval Invincibles will be the next most valuable one. And I think they could make serious coin for not that much of that stake, of that 51% stake. And I you know, then the likes of Leicestershire or Gloucestershire, who don't have a team currently in the 100, are not going to have that money available to them. So they're just going to have a share of what the ECB sells. So it's that's my fear. I think it will, that the money will be amazing for the likes of Gloucestershire and Leicestershire, but I think the gap between the haves and the have-nots will get wider.
And Will, what else does it mean for, you know, English cricket? I'm with you on that one, I think. Yeah, the point that you make is absolutely spot on. I know Mark Butcher's been talking on another podcast about, you know, the tough conversation of 18 counties. You know, are we at a point where we are going to start losing counties, and is that the best for the game? And I don't disagree with Butch many times, but I do disagree on this one. I think we desperately need 18 counties, because it's not about 100. It's about producing players from all four corners of the UK to try and make the England team, you know, English cricket better. Well, if this does get sold off like it does, and the counties, you know, come in and say, oh, we've got no choice, we have to take it because we are strapped for cash, What does it mean for our cricket calendar and where does our players? Because like you said before, they ain't coming in for a minority stake. They're coming in like the SA20 and, you know, they're going to run the game for a 6-8 week period in this country. What happens with the England cricket team if they're playing at the same time?
Yeah, well, I think that's going to be a big battleground, actually, that, again, these guys, they don't come in for minority stakes and they also don't come in for second best when it comes to players. So, you know, this year, for instance, the 100 does clash with England test matches, at, I think, at both ends of the 100, actually, at the start and the finish. I would think that in future summers, just like in 2023, when it was quite controversial, the Ashes was over by the end of July, I would think we'll be seeing things like that a bit more, where the 100 does actually get a window of exclusivity. Because is the 100 something that is going to really do its job without the likes of Ben Stokes or Johnny Bairstow, the kind of cross-format superstars, without them bothering Harry Brook? If they see it as a moment to take a break, well, that's a problem for the 100. So, yeah, and these guys, if let's take the Ambani family, who famously own Mumbai Indians. They now own MI Cape Town team in the UAE as well. They're going to want to have their top players playing.
Finally, Will, you know, we've already seen South Africa send a C team to New Zealand to play test matches. It's coming. It'll happen. If this sale goes ahead, there will inevitably, there aren't 15 months or 16 months in a year. And so England will be fielding weakened test teams, I think. And finally, heard any whispers at all about turning it from a 16.4 into a T20 tournament?
I don't think that'll happen immediately, but I don't think that'll happen to the cast cycle, and that runs 25 to 28. So possibly in 2029, I think the 100 format, obviously, it's really wound people up, and I wouldn't have chosen to do it myself. I don't think it's necessarily better than T20, but what I will say is it is my view that it's a bit of a red herring intention around the thing generally, and that actually it does serve a purpose in the competition's current format, which is that they play, one of the accidental successes actually of the tournament is they play this, yeah, the women's game and men's on the ground on the same day. Now I think if you were to add 80 balls to that that day's cricket, I think the object of that would be defeated slightly, and I don't think it would be possible. What I would say is, in the next few years, where the women's 100 is not being played as double headers alongside the men, like if they're giving the women's tournament a different schedule essentially, and playing it at different venues at different times, that's when I think it could become a T20 competition. But while it remains this really nice package where they play two games in a day, I think it will remain 100 balls. I could be wrong. I don't think the conversation will ever go away, because the 100 ball format is elsewhere. People silly and five ball overs and all the rest of it. And yeah, it is a bit, but it kind of works for the event that the 100 currently has on.
You're listening to Following On here on TalkSport 2 with the former number one fast bowler in the world, number one bowler in the world, Steve Harmison. Next up, we'll be joined by Nathan Johns from the Irish Times to discuss the news that Ireland will be playing a home series against South Africa in Abu Dhabi this year.
Flimsy stand slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armodillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo. Built to last. Designed to impress.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The Following On podcast is proudly sponsored by Barbados Tourism. If your passion for travel is on par with your passion for cricket, then I have some excellent news. The ICC Men's Cricket T20 World Cup final is being hosted in Barbados this June, which makes it the perfect destination for your summer holidays this year. To make the most of your trip, you can also experience 8 matches from the series in Barbados, including England against Scotland and England against Australia. In under a month's time, you could be spending your days exploring the vibrant streets of Bridgetown, drinking rum in the sunshine and experiencing exotic Bajan delicacies in the culinary capital of the Caribbean. There truly is something for everyone. There's no need to wait a second longer. Head to visitbarbados.org/cricket today to book the trip of a lifetime to Barbados. Truly the best place to be a cricket fan.
You're listening to Following On here on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, along with former England fast bowler Steve Harmison. And if you missed any of the show or you wish to catch up, you can download the podcast, as always, from the Following On feed, now available via the free TalkSport app or wherever you get your podcasts. Delighted to say, old friend of the programme, Nathan Johns, cricket writer for the Irish Times, joins us once again. Harmy and I were keen to talk to you last week, Nath, when we first heard that Ireland were undergoing a significant rearrangement of their home fixtures, very significant rearrangement. But we weren't on top of the story, but now we're still not on top of the story. That's why we've got you on. So basically, Ireland are now playing their home games in the UAE. They'll be hosting South Africa there. They cancelled a series against Australia, which sounds pretty dramatic. Do just give us an overview before we fire a couple of questions at you.
Of course, it's been a strange few months. Postponing fixtures, as Cricket Ireland always say, these fixtures gets postponed. They always say the future tours program commitments will eventually be upheld, and even if it's they're not in the year that they're designated. But fixtures being postponed or moved abroad is not something new for Cricket Ireland. If we remember, in 2022, they hosted South Africa in Bristol. Last year, they hosted Bangladesh in Chelmsford. So none of this is new, but I suppose the extent and the drip feed of information and the way it's come out in recent months is very new. I think the middle of March, it was just before St. Patrick's Day, there was an interview that went up where a Cricket Ireland employee was quoted as saying, "We don't know what's going to happen with the Australia series." I then managed to go out and we reported in the Irish Times that the Australia series was gone, and that the South Africa series was in the UAE. It took them 6 weeks to confirm the fixture schedule after that because of various ICC meetings where they were looking for extra funding that they're going to get anyway in 4 years' time. They tried to get it early. That didn't happen. The cost of hosting South Africa in the UAE went up. So they've constantly been forced to, at the last minute, redraw budgets and go back to square one, so to speak. But finally, just over a week ago now, there was a board meeting where budgets were finalised. They were secure. Fixtures were announced, but you know, the top line is there is going to be a home test match, in the first ever in Belfast in Northern Ireland during the summer, which is obviously a significant story. But that only comes because the white ball portion of the tour at Zimbabwe they're playing, the white ball portion of that tour has been postponed. The Australia series has been postponed, and they can only afford to host South Africa in the UAE. On the men's side, the England women's tour is still going ahead to Ireland. That is happening in Ireland. I think a lot of people were concerned that might not happen. That's still happening. And if they qualify for the World Cup, those qualifiers are still going on. They'll get a bonus, basically, and they'll be able to host some more women's matches during the summer.
And Nathan, what is it? You know, they're going to, you know, the UAE. You mentioned, the Bristol, the Chelmsford. Would it not make a huge amount of sense to sort of stage it in the UK? You know, where they've got, had they even contemplated trying to go down the route of a drop-in pitch in a TV show with the sort of the GA with in the hurling, and they're big grounds. There's some huge hurling grounds. You know, that could probably get a cricket pitch in. Would that not be better to try and then get people in, or try and play in Manchester or Liverpool, where there are cricket grounds where Irish fans could potentially jump on a boat, get over and see, and that then lifts the whole country of people going over and watching their team rather than just seeing them on the television from 5,000 miles away.
It is a strange one. You're right. I mean, the idea of going to a GAA stadium that you're suggesting, it's never one, as far as I'm aware, that's been considered seriously by Cricket Ireland, at least publicly. They haven't said they've considered that idea. Quite a lot of people have suggested it. It's difficult to do so in the summer months, just because that's when the GAA season is on as well. I suspect if you're going to get a big GAA venue, that would also be quite very expensive. And that's ultimately the biggest issue here. They're playing Pakistan in Dublin just before the T20 World Cup. The men are. At one point, those fixtures were going to be in the UK. There were very significant discussions held there. There were a few venues that were touted. That they were in discussion with a few county grounds, one prominent London ground, shall we say, but that didn't come to fruition for whatever reason. So I suspect with regard to the South Africa games, the timing is an issue when they're happening end of September into October, as far as I believe, if I remember correctly. So, I mean, that's, you're not going to get any games in the UK or Ireland at all at that stage, let alone if you had a ground or not. So I wonder if that was a factor in terms of the UK, but Cricket Ireland are adamant that it made more financial sense for them to play that game, those matches rather, in the UAE. Like I said, they explored the option of looking at other grounds in the UK for other series, but for whatever reason, and I suspect it's financial, they've landed the way they've landed.
Nathan, just finally, I know that we're not financial journalists or economic journalists, but is it your understanding that if Ireland had a dedicated headquarters, a ground, that may well be able to be multifunctional, but if they had a cricket ground, that the business of Irish cricket would be sustainable? It's just setting up, it's that cost, that initial cost, and it would be at 10, 15 million pounds, which is a small amount, it's a drop in the ocean in the global cricket scheme of things, isn't it, really? Is it just the fact that they have to build stands and the infrastructure has to be put up and taken down every time they have a home series?
That's the main issue. There are other issues, like, for example, the most favoured ground in Ireland is Malahide. They're not playing there this summer because of it's a heritage site in a way, and there's council things that need to be done, and there are extra costs, and they're not paying those this year. They're playing elsewhere. Cricket Ireland portray the issue as, yes, if there was a stadium, if they had somewhere they could call their own, it was permanent, and crucially, if it was paid for them rather than by them, yes. I don't know if they'd be financially viable, because they'd still be heavily reliant on external funding from governments and ICC in the way they are. I think 70% of their funding currently comes from the ICC. They'd still be reliant on them, but they perhaps would be able to fulfil all their FTP commitments and they wouldn't be postponing series. The short answer is yes. Where they're at with that is there's a government sport campus where lots of sports training centres and facilities are. That's where they're currently, their high performance centre is. That's where they're hoping to get a stadium built there. And they're essentially, the line is, they're waiting on the government to pony up and give them the money to build the stadium there, the Irish government, that is. And until that happens, it's going to be a long wait. There's a significant deadline. They need to get it built by 2030 when they host T20 World Cup games in partnership with England. They probably risk getting that taken off them if they don't have a proper stadium in place by then. At this stage, it's a big if. Nobody's able to say when the government's going to give the money. The government has said they will, but there's lots of main significant projects at the minute ahead of Irish cricket in the queue at that campus. For example, there's an indoor cycling velodrome that needs to be built in that campus before a cricket stadium can be built. And because Cricket Ireland aren't paying for it and they're waiting on the government, they just have to, as the CEO said in an interview, they just have to take a ticket and wait in line.
And Nathan, where are Ireland at the minute with regards of the mention the World T20? They do play India in that tournament. They play Pakistan as well, Canada. How do you think Ireland will fare? What's the build-up been like? Got Pakistan coming. You know, do they really fancy their chances of causing an upset like they have done in previous tournaments?
I think they'll always fancy the chances, like you said there. It's part of Irish cricket DNA, isn't it? There's a lot of doom and gloom about fixtures and funding, but every couple of years they get a World Cup upset and everyone's happy for a few months. They absolutely will fancy their chances. I think, in a way, they play India first, and in a way that probably suits them because they always start these tournaments incredibly slowly. They got heavily beaten out the gate by Zimbabwe in the last World Cup, and then they recovered to still make the next stage, and where they played England in Melbourne. So in a way, that suits them. If they don't slip up against the USA and Canada, the other team in their groups, they go into the final match against Pakistan in what could be a winner-takes-all qualifying match. And like you said, they play Pakistan in three T20s in Dublin before that tournament. So there'll be an element of familiarity and they absolutely will back themselves. T20 is a format where they've improved massively over the last 18 months. Their 50-over stuff has been pretty disastrous, actually. That World Cup qualifying campaign last year was nothing short of a disaster, but their T20 fortunes have actually been reasonably okay. But we mentioned that World Cup where they in the rain-assisted game, they beat England, they beat Scotland, they beat the West Indies. So they're reasonably confident of being in a position where if they're in a one-off game against Pakistan and a winner takes all, they can they might be able to cause an upset.
Nathan Johns, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you once again, cricket writer for the Irish Times. But I'm going to leave the final word to you, because on the field, despite all the grief and shenanigans and hard work off the field, on the field, things are still looking pretty bright, aren't they?
I think so, yeah. Well, the women had a big qualifier to win today over Zimbabwe. They're quite a good news story under a Sussex player, Ed Joyce. He's their head coach now, and they're doing quite well. Could do with a bit more depth, but they've got two or three players that if they fire, they'll probably be top six, top seven countries in the world, which is that's fantastic for where that team has been in the past. And yeah, you're right. Look, the men, they got that test match victory, the first one. They got the monkey off the back against Afghanistan. Unfortunately, that was overshadowed by, let's call it, corporate governance issues and stories that emanated from Ireland in recent weeks. I don't want to get into that necessarily because that's a different can of worms. But that did happen. They did go to the UAE and they did win one T20 against Afghanistan, which, given those conditions, I think that was a significant achievement. And look, on the men's side, coming into a World Cup, they've got a clear T20 identity. They know how they're going to win their matches. And, you know, on the right day, it can come off for them. And I think with where they are, with the lack of facilities, lack of infrastructure, lack of depth, that's all they can ask for. And they're probably in as good a position T20-wise as they have been in recent memory. And the line that comes both externally from Cricket Ireland and also from people who I speak to within the organisation, you know, on the playing and coaching side, is a lot of what they achieve is in spite of the way things are run and the challenges off the pitch rather than because of them. And look, now that they are getting more ICC money, they'll still have to postpone FTP commitments going forward, but they'll have more clarity and hopefully it won't be as chaotic and drip-feed information as it has been in the past. So on the field, yeah, there's always reasons to be positive with Irish cricket. They always find a way of pulling something out of the bag. And finally, some structures are coming good. There's just a lot of other ones that people would like to see improve.
Nathan Johns, cricket writer for the Irish Times. You're listening to Following On here on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, and Durham Hall of Famer Steve Harmison.
And you can now watch us on YouTube if you're not already doing that. Just head over to the TalkSport Cricket YouTube channel and don't forget to subscribe. Let's talk about Pakistan then, Harmy. I'm obsessed with Pakistan cricket's obsession with overseas coaches. They've got some very good ones of their own. Azhar Mahmood has been in temporary charge of the side and will remain as an assistant coach, but they've gone double overseas in their latest move, with Jason Gillespie appointed as the test coach and Gary Kirsten appointed as the new white ball head coach. The theory is that there's so much infighting in Pakistan cricket that like the locals won't take the job. And if they do, they don't last more than a couple of months. But you know, they've gone a couple of big names there.
Yeah, two big names, two powerful names in coaching in world cricket. Dizzy's been fantastic for a whole host of, you know, counties in England, Yorkshire and Sussex, as well as is doing brilliantly in the strikers in Adelaide. And Gary Kirsten doesn't need any introduction in the coaching role. He won everything he possibly could with India. So I think in this role, we spoke about you know, the director of cricket in the first section of this show, is that he has to be the most important thing. If Rob Key's in charge of Pakistan cricket, at a director of cricket level, you can have a Jason Gillespie, Gary Kirsten, and it works perfectly. I think if you have two split coaches, you've got to have a director of cricket that can have enough, you know, kudos with the big bosses upstairs to understand, obviously understand the game, make sure that both coaches get what they want. They're not going to get everything they want, but the majority of the time they get what they want. And then put a local, which will be a Pakistan-based coaching team, in with them. In the Kirsten Gillespie role is to create an environment which can make Pakistan players, red and white ball players, thrive. So if they get the director of cricket right, they've got a chance with the two split coaches, because two great men, two really good men. You know, Gary Kirsten, yeah, as well as anybody, man. As I've known Jason Gillespie for a number of years, playing with him, playing against him and playing for him. Two good men who I think can do a good job there. But I think the most important role in this whole organisation is the director of cricket. If he gets it right, Pakistan can thrive because they've got some unbelievably talented players. But I think it's about how the director of cricket manages upstairs and then give the coach what he needs to move forward. And Pakistan have got some fantastic players. I think that should be, you know, the nice, smooth road. But as we know, with Pakistan and the West Indies and one or two other boards around the world, it doesn't matter how good a players you've got. If you're a shambles at the top, unfortunately, it filters down. And when it comes to world tournaments, Pakistan and the West Indies have had their, I think they've had their own successes of being possible tournament favourites and ended up going out before the team song was sung because they've been a shambles from above.
Exactly. You can't control the environment in which you work. I mean, they're both eminently qualified, as you say, as coaches and as people and as empathizers and facilitators. But you need a knife-proof chest guard for your back. Someone decides that they don't want you to succeed. They can make life very difficult. So best of luck to them. And Gary Kirsten has promised to come on in the next couple of weeks to us. Let's talk about the IPL then and the success stories. Johnny Bairstow, absolutely astonishing. 108 not out of 48 balls. A record T20 chase, not just IPL chase. 262 for the Punjab Kings. As you say, unfortunately, it would probably be one swallow. And it's not going to make the Punjab Kings summer. But absolutely fabulous to see Johnny do that. And then Will Jacks. Here's the most astonishing thing about Will Jacks. You know, when I was watching the game and his second 50 came from 10 balls, I don't find that nearly as shocking as the fact that his first 17 runs came from 17 balls. Who does that in the modern T20 game? He finished 100 not out of 41 balls. And do you know what? I'm watching it at the beginning thinking, what are you doing, Will Jacks? What are you doing? You 17 off 17. You're losing the game.
Yeah. It was madness, wasn't it? It was. I couldn't believe it. I was going to say I just watched the highlights, but I think if you get under 41 balls, you're watching the whole innings, aren't you? So I think they kept the 17 balls. I think they just started when he hit his 18th run. It was brilliant. Come on to Johnny first. I missed it. I'm honestly devastated. I missed his selection because if I knew he was going to get picked, I'd have put a fortune on getting big, big score because this is what Johnny does. The minute Johnny gets talked about, the minute his position's under fire, the minute he's under pressure himself, bang, Johnny comes back with a big bang and obviously got his runs. But and that's why you can't rule him out. I know we mentioned quite a few wicketkeepers. You can't rule him out for the summer at number seven because he can do this, and this is Johnny Bairstow. So Will Jacks, I think everybody knows that Will Jacks is a supreme talent. And when we've seen that sort of second 50 off 10 balls, we've talked in the first section about Rob Key and mentioned him a director of cricket there in Pakistan. I think you have to look at what Keyes did when it comes to selection for the test squads, selection for India. He left Will Jacks out and said to Will Jacks, go and play PSL, go and play 2020 cricket. Because we want you ready for the T20 World Cup. And hopefully, Will Jacks is just coming into form just at the right time because that was breathtaking. You had Virat Kohli at the other end. You made Virat Kohli look like just an innocent bystander at the other end. That's like the greatest player that's played in the modern generation, in my opinion, is Virat Kohli. And he's standing there just wetting himself laughing. He was just, it was a brilliant sign coming off. If I was Will Jacks' mum and dad, I'd have that picture on my wall, blown up. You know, Virat Kohli standing there with his arm around Will Jacks, and just a cap on, with a smile on his face, bat in the air, and you could see in Virat's face the delight for Will, the greatest cricketer for me in the modern generation. To see Will Jacks play that innings with that man at the other end shows what a great talent we've got in from English cricket, and hopefully he can go and do that in the Caribbean. So, yeah, carrying on from a T20 manners. The South African squad's been picked for the World T20. The New Zealand squad's been picked. I like the New Zealand squad. That looks a good, good side. We've actually got some nice kit as well, which is going a really big throwback. But What do you make of the South African squad? That looks a good squad, a good all-round squad. Any headlines, highlights? I see they've sort of not gone down the player of colour they've gone away from having that as a... So will that cause problems in South Africa, or will it be, you know, we've got the best team, we're going to go out and win a tournament?
It's a watershed moment for sure, absolutely. First of all, I'll say that it was a brave selection to go with Anrich Norkia, who, yeah, as you know, is having a wretched IPL. I mean, he's the only player to have been hit for 20-plus four times in an over, and one went for 32, last over of the innings. You remember, I think it was Romario Shepherd popped him in the stands five times. So that's a big, brave call. But it is the first time that South Africa have... not adhered to the compulsory racial quotas. It was always half the squad there had to be seven or eight players of colour, three of whom had to be Black African. So it's the first time in 20 years that they have not gone down that route. Of course, there will be repercussions at board level. There'll be lots of recrimination. But Rob Walter is the head coach, the white ball coach, and sole selector. But he had to have the squad approved by the director of cricket, Enoch Nkwe. So, I mean, in a way, they're being set up to fail. You know, if they don't win the World Cup, then the activists in South Africa will be up in arms and say, well, you know, if we can't win with the best team, then why are we disbanding quotas? But Rob Walter did also say that they would absolutely adhere to those quotas in bilateral series in the years ahead, and he's promised that the 2027 World Cup, 50 over World Cup, which is in South Africa, of course, the team will be absolutely demographically representative. So it is really, really interesting and well spotted, by the way. Thanks for putting me on the spot. It's time to move on to the final word. I've got no doubt at all about what it should be this week, but I do want to mention the Vanuatu women's team. 10 days before crowdfunding, in order to get to the Women's T20 World Cup qualifying tournament, they were asking people to help them get to the event. Their first game is their first ever game against a major nation, Zimbabwe. They knock them over for 64 and win the game. Absolutely brilliant. So, unfortunately, they don't qualify for our final word this week, but brilliant, brilliant story, and lots of other great stories there as well. Ireland going well, as we heard from Nathan earlier. But the final word has to go to two lads who you must know very, very well, and who are doing a good job of taking the spotlight off Charlie Harmison, because the sons of your great mate, Andrew Flintoff, Rocky and Corey, playing for Lancashire Second 11, and Rocky breaking his dad's record for the youngest player to score a century for Lancs 2s. That's just brilliant. And then, by the way, Lancashire dropped the media barricades around both boys. We wouldn't let them speak to the media after they themselves had promoted Rocky's innings on social media.
Yeah, they promoted themselves on Rocky's innings, but rightly so. I wouldn't let anybody speak to my lad if it was like this. I want him to... Especially with the pressure that he's under, having the surname he's got, it was brilliant to see, wasn't it? He's a better player on the leg side than his dad, but his dad. It's a little bit harder than him at the minute, but fair play. Rock's only 16, so no, it was great to see. I was with Andrew a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about how good Rocky was going, and Corey as well. I've got to remember, Corey played in the game, which seems to have gone under the radar as well. Corey's only 18, and he played in the game, and he bowled nicely. I think he bowled nine or 10 overs in the first innings, 4 or 5 overs in the second innings. So it's good to see them both do well. Anybody that's played cricket, that's played for England, that sibling, yeah, the kids have come through, that they've had the surname to live up to. And Rocky and Corey have definitely got a big, big character to live up to. One thing I'll say on Rocky, we ain't seen the best of him yet. We ain't seen him bowl yet. And when you see him bowl, the boy can bowl. He's got a bit of pace, but like his old man, like Andrew, growing up, I've known Andrew since he was 17. So he struggled early in his career with back problems and So Rocky had a stress fracture not long ago. So the caution on his bowling, but his batting was brilliant. It was fantastic to see. It was a throwback to yesteryear when Andrew belted everybody all over the place. I first met Andrew Flintoff at the age of 14, I think, 14 or 15. He's a year older than me. We played Ashing played against St. Anne's. We played in the semi-finals of the national knockout. We played at York Cricket Club, and we were playing on the next pitch to St. Anne's. And all the talk about this big character, Flintoff, he had just scored 240, I think, in a 20-over game at under-15s. And everything was about Flintoff. And, you know, Rocky's just starting that. This is exactly what it was like all them years ago when kids used to turn up to play against St. Anne's, because Andrew was big, strong, powerful, hit balls for sixes and fours. And his son's just done the same. And it's great to see. I hope people from the outside, the media, just let him be and let him play his game, because it is going to be difficult for him. And Archie's doing really well. Archie Vaughan's doing well down at Somerset. A lot of good. Like Mark Elam's son's doing really well as well. So having dads that played for England is sometimes hard enough. So hopefully they just let them get on with their careers. But, you know, first impressions, 16-year-old to beat his dad's record, which has stood for the best part of, 30 years, tells you that Rocky Flintoff has got some big shoes to fill, but he's got a huge amount of talent. But don't forget Corey as well, because Corey can bowl. And yeah, I'm sure in the next few weeks, when the second team fixtures get more and more, you know, you might see Corey Flintoff make the headlines, because he can also play cricket as well.
Does make you wonder about the sense of Michael Atherton insisting that his son Josh took his mum's surname, doesn't it? I mean, yeah. The surname is the albatross around your neck, potentially. Yes, it might open a few doors for you, but it can be.
It does, but when you watch that innings that Rocky did when he got 100, there was no surname around his neck there. There was no dad. My dad's Andrew Flintoff, when the ball was pitching back of a length, and he kept rocking off the back foot and pulling it for six. So it was great to see. He's got so much character. Corey's a little bit quieter than Rock. Rock's a lot more like the old man. Two very, very good young cricketers who hopefully, fingers crossed, can progress through Lancashire, get into the first team. And, you know, Rocky set one of his dad's records. I don't think you'll come anywhere near his drinking records, but fingers crossed. And I'm sure dad will say, I hope he breaks every record that Andrew ever set, because if he does, they'll both have fantastic careers.
You've been listening to Following On here on TalkSport 2 with me, Neil Manthorpe, along with former England fast bowler Steve Harmison. And if you missed any of the show, you can always catch up. Download the podcast from the Following On feed. We'll be back at a similar time next week. But for now, you've been listening to another edition of Following On.
The Following On podcast is proudly sponsored by Barbados Tourism. And this is your gentle reminder that Barbados is the best place to be a cricket fan. With 8 matches from the ICC Men's T20 Cricket World Cup Series taking place in Barbados this summer, including the final, you can experience the summer of a lifetime by booking today. Aside from immersing in world-class cricket in the sunshine, Barbados is the dream destination for all travel enthusiasts. It is where adventure meets paradise, the culinary capital of the Caribbean, and better still, the birthplace of rum. If you're keen to unite with cricket fans across the globe for what is set to be an unforgettable summer, then head to visitbarbados.org/cricket today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly, and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.